Creation Boogaloo in Maplewood, a swinging good time, a gracious plenty establishment.
Your trusted voice for news.
Hey, this is Christine Niff, and you're listening to Relationships 101, because relating isn't always easy. Happy Easter to everyone out there who celebrates, and happy anything else to those who perhaps don't. For those of you in St. Louis today, how about that snow? I expected to wake up and have a little sunshine, some little Easter eggs, and I don't know, bunnies out there in the green, and we had a lot of snow, so that, I don't know, that really wasn't very much fun. But our guest tonight doesn't know about that because she is from California. I believe she's in San Diego. We have a really good show this evening. We're starting to get a lot of authors on. This is a show all about relationships. It's called Relationships 101. So, yeah, it's about free, solid, friendly, helpful, hopefully, and professional advice. We're having all kinds of people on. We had Crazy Love on the other day. It was a great psychologist. She wrote a book, a co-authored one, about being involved with people with personality disorders. We're having something coming up in a couple weeks called Boot Camp for the Brokenhearted. We got a lot of good things coming up. Tonight we have an author. Her name is Peggy Vaughn. She is the author of The Monogamy Myth, a personal handbook for recovering from affairs. Featured on Oprah, 48 Hours, CNN, Fox News, and USA Today, Peggy Vaughn's book has been heralded as one of the most valuable survival and recovery guides for men or women experiencing a partner's unfaithfulness. Drawing on actual case studies, research, and Vaughn's own experience, this landmark book helps us to understand the stages of suspicion, confrontation, and the healing process necessary to recover, including rebuilding self-esteem, the marriage divorce dilemma, and seeking professional help. Vaughn shares her practical, time-tested advice and successful strategies to help move beyond the affair. One early reviewer of this book said, "When we see women's husbands have affairs, they get a divorce. Others stay married and suffer in silence. Peggy Vaughn's husband had affairs, and she made a career out of it." Hi, Peggy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Christine. What an introduction.
Did you like that? You like that one? I love that one that I picked out.
Yeah, that's really my favorite, because that's what happened. My husband had affairs 40 years ago, and
okay.
We worked through it, and after about 6 years after he told me about them, we finally gradually began talking more openly about it and wound up writing a book about our experience. And as you can imagine, it hit a big chord, because this is going on and has been going on for a long time, but people have kept it secret, and now, of course, we still get a lot of exposure of public figures, but it's still quite secretive among the regular people. And so I kind of opened up the floodgates and really did launch me into this. I heard from so many people who identified with my situation and who had never talked to anybody. And so through the years, they wound up telling me things they didn't even tell their therapist, because they felt like I understood it in a different way. And I really got sucked into learning so much from so many people that I felt like I should write about it. And so the book you are talking about, The Monogamy Myth, I really wrote after, 9 years after I wrote my first book about my story, because I learned so much. And this is how we really find out. It's not from the experts who've studied it. It's from the people who've lived it. And that's where I have gotten my learning from, is all the people who lived it. And so here I am, let's see, 28 years after I went public, still doing this. But you can't not do it, I think, once you have successfully survived it. You want to help other people. But it's not about just staying married. It's about recovering, which, some people stay married and recover, and some people stay married and don't. Some people get a divorce and recover, and some people get a divorce and don't.
Right. It definitely runs the gamut in there. And listen, it's interesting, because you talk about sort of the secrecy behind it. The title is called The Monogamy Myth. It sounds like you're not trying to say, from what I read, that that you can't necessarily have monogamy. It's just that, people think monogamy is the norm, and an affair is just a strange little exception that some bad people have happen, and then they're shocked when the whole thing goes down.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that up front, because the book title has been very misleading, and under no circumstances am I saying that monogamy is a myth. I'm saying we have so many beliefs about monogamy that are myths that make it really hard for us to hold on to the monogamy that we intend to have when we get married, because almost everybody, every survey ever done has shown that like 85 to 90% of people say they're committed to monogamy, they think affairs are wrong, and yet despite that, it keeps happening. So you got to understand, okay, what else is going on? And so besides just whatever personal failings there might be, there are a lot of other things, including the societal factors is what I call them, and like you say, the myths are that most people are monogamous, that you can assume monogamy when you get married, that society supports monogamy, and none of those things are true. So,
and I think that
uphill battle.
Yes, and I think that attributes to the interesting responses I get. I read this book, and I really enjoyed this book, and I'll be honest, I enjoyed it from a personal standpoint, not because I've, you know, experienced an affair, but because as a therapist working in private practice and working a lot with couples, it doesn't come up quite as much as I guess I would assume, but it does come up, and this is an excellent handbook for that. But what's interesting is, based on everything you say, what's interesting is the reactions I get when I've been telling people all week, oh, I'm going to have this great author on, you know, her book is great, it's called The Monogamy Myth, yada, yada, and you get, people get like sort of quiet and go, oh, or you get, oh, that's kind of neat. It's like the whole middle gray is missing on that.
Yeah, what happens is, this whole issue, as you know, is so emotion-laden that most people can't step back and just think rationally, so that it triggers an immediate knee-jerk reaction. And most people, the minute they hear the monogamy myth, it's like, oh, no, 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 no. Monogamy can't be a myth. And they don't even stop to hear what you might be trying to explain about what you're really saying.
That's exactly
That's
right.
That's all what I'm saying. But since it's such an emotional issue, it's just so hard for anybody to stop long enough from their emotions get triggered, and therefore they never stop to hear what it is you're actually saying. And I understand this because, you know, I was like a lot of other people. And the way most people deal with affairs, they want to ignore it or deny it, and then if they are confronted with it, they just want to condemn it. But they don't really want to understand it because it's just too scary.
Yeah, listen, let me ask you something before we go to a break here. And we're going to, trust me, we're not leaving the book or anything. But I talked a couple weeks ago about the whole Elliot Spitzer thing, which, you know, is going around and around. Here was my question to you. I mean, I've got my theories on it, but you have studied this and dealt with this. Extramarital affairs, can you give some, you know, verbiage on the difference in emotions that the women are going to feel when they went out and had an emotional affair, they got emotionally attached with a woman versus what Elliot Spitzer did and just went out and had sexual encounters?
Right. Do you have time for me to say something now, or you want me to hold it?
Oh, no, you go right ahead. We got a couple minutes.
Okay, here's the thing. People assume when you're looking from the outside in that there's some kind of continuum, that if it's a one-night stand or it's a prostitute, that that's not as bad. But if it's a long-term affairs or multiple affairs or affairs with a friend, then it's awful. What they don't appreciate is that each individual person can only deal with whatever's confronting them.
That's correct.
They're not looking at it in this kind of abstract way. And when it happens to you, it's irrelevant as to the circumstances, because I have had people be just as devastated where it was a one-night stand or even an online affair, an emotional affair where there never was even in sex, be just as devastated as the person whose spouse had multiple affairs or a long-term affair, because it's not as if you can make that comparison. Once it's you, and here's why, Christine, why it doesn't. Because I also did a survey and discovered that people recover from the fact that their partner had sex with someone else before they recover from the fact they were deceived. It's the deception that is so devastating, and the deception is the same regardless of what kind of affair it was.
Yes.
So when we're trying to judge, you know, how serious is this versus that, they're all the same degree of seriousness in terms of and in light of the fact that it's the deception. It's like, my spouse isn't who I thought they were. My marriage isn't what I thought it was. My world isn't what I thought it was. So the specifics of the affair is not critical in the way that people looking from the outside in think it would be, because the rock bottom is my world has been shattered. It's been turned upside down. I don't know what's going on. I've got to define a whole reality, new reality for myself, and it really doesn't matter to the individual where they slotted on that continuum.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. Listen, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to get, you know, you lay it right out there in the framework. I want to get to the part about, you know, why affairs happen, and really I want to get into that part about the personal blame that you talk about, whether you're blaming yourself for the affair, whether you're blaming your partner, the third person. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be returning with Peggy Vaughn.
Welcome back to Relationships 101 and Christine Niffen on KMOX.
Hey there, KMOX reminds you to support CHAMP, our Voice of Caring partner for March. Join CHAMP Assistance Dogs' goal of providing service dogs to those with disabilities. Please visit KMOX.com for details about how to support CHAMP. Listen, and we are talking with Peggy Vaughn. She's author of The Monogamy Myth, a personal handbook for recovering from affairs. We were talking before the break all about sort of the myths of monogamy and the problems that cause. So, Peggy, I'd like to get to this. Why affairs happen? I want to talk about why we blame, who we blame. And I loved what you said earlier. You know, I came up, when you had the section on how society contributes to the affairs, I thought of a couple logical ones, but you threw a whole bunch in there that I really hadn't looked at and thought about.
I'm not interested in promoting a book that's not even out yet, but I just want you to know that I've just completed a book about preventing affairs, and I get down to the really rock bottom, way back. If you want to understand why affairs happen, you cannot start with the assumptions we make. We almost always assume it's because of problems in the marriage or because of some weakness in the individual who has an affair. Gradually through the years, we're learning that it's not just bad people have affairs and good people don't, or it happens to good people in good marriages. I mean, I can't tell you how many members of the clergy I've worked with. There's nobody, it doesn't matter how upstanding you are, how moral you are, everybody's vulnerable. And one of the reasons we are is because of the fact that well, here's the best way I can describe it. Why people have affairs. I see it kind of almost like a three-legged stool. I don't write about this, but it's my way of kind of explaining it. It's like a three-legged stool. There are all these factors that we assume that everybody jumps to and thinks that's the whole thing that I just mentioned about problems in the marriage and stuff. But that's just the things that might push you into an affair. Another that's essential leg of the stool is the things that pull you into an affair, just the excitement, the curiosity, and the novelty and all that kind of stuff where people, you know, get carried away and they fall into an affair and they never meant to kind of thing. And then the third leg of the stool is the societal factors, our fascination with affairs, the way we glorify it, the way we have so much secrecy about it. And when you get even below that, the way that we use sex to sell. I mean, you know, a man buying a car, almost any product, looks like he's supposed to have a new sexy woman model to go with it.
And listen, if I got to see any more of these Viagra commercials while they're riding motorcycles, I mean, come on.
But to get down beneath it, when you really get back to understanding just how deep it is that we're conditioned into having a hard time to stay monogamous, it really starts when we are children growing up and our parents do not establish an open line of communication about sexual issues. Maybe we get the talk about the plumbing, but almost nobody opens up an open line of communication so that as young people we learn that sex and secrecy go hand in hand, so that when we become teenagers we start having sex and we pretend to our parents that we aren't. So that when you get married and you're tempted just as you were in a teenager and you know you're not supposed to do it, you already have experience with how to deal with it. You're already conditioned. You go ahead and do it and pretend you're not. I mean, I can speak for this personally. My husband and I grew up together. I knew him our entire lives. We started first grade together. We had the same background, the same commitments, the same values and everything. And when I learned about his affairs, I could not imagine how this person that I knew so well could possibly present this image of being so upright and upstanding and at the same time have all this stuff that he was keeping secret, until it finally occurred to me he was doing exactly what we did as teenagers, sneaking around having sex and hiding it from our parents. None of this is to be an excuse. This is what people say. When I try to point out the societal factors, again, it's so emotional that people want to say, oh, you're blaming it on society. Not at all. I'm saying if we don't understand the context within which affairs happen, if each one of us tries to reinvent the wheel by figuring it out just by looking at our relationship, we can't do it. And when it happens to us, as a woman, you almost invariably first think, what was wrong with me? Was I not smart enough, sexy enough, pretty enough? What was wrong with me? And then we just say, well, okay, what was wrong with him? But we never expand it to get beyond just that one leg of the stool, just the things that push people into affairs. And until we get beyond that, we're just going to have, because when you think it's just you, that everybody else is monogamous and something that's wrong with you or your partner or your marriage is why this happened, then it just brings about such devastation that there's no way that you can put it into a context that allows you to make sense. It's crazy making. But if you expand that to get more understanding of how there's a lot of people, just the curiosity, the novelty, the excitement, and then these societal factors, plus this way we got conditioned in secrecy growing up, then it's more understandable. So it's not a matter of blame or excusing. It's a matter of understanding. And this is the hardest sell of all, is to get people to recognize that they don't know that they don't know. I mean, we have our assumptions and our stereotypes about affairs, who has them and why.
Right.
All of that is dead wrong. And any time somebody says, well, it happened because, and they fill it in with one thing, it's wrong, because it's always a combination of factors. It's never one thing.
Right. You said that's too narrow of a focus, doing things like blaming one thing. Here's my question, though. I really like the part you said for myself personally as a therapist about how therapists, you feel, sometimes take the wrong approach, that we see it as, you know, strictly almost like there were problems in the relationships. That's why it happened. Well, I kind of get what you're saying, but help me out with this one. It seems I kind of am a person who notices patterns. Working with all the different people. It seems to me, though, it does happen in the context of people not being connected. So I guess I feel that's problems in the marriage.
It is. Here's the problem with the therapist. I have a website I've had for 12 years. It's dearpeggy.com. And I have a list of therapists. I have over 200 therapists who are specifically good at dealing with affairs.
Okay.
The problem with marital therapists frequently is, and I've been hearing this feedback for many, many years, which is why I undertook this study, John Gottman, the famous researcher.
Right.
Peggy, you have got a lot of understandings here, but unless you do a research project and you have statistics, the therapists are not going to believe you.
Right.
That. And it turns out that I was absolutely dead on. And that what happens is that marital therapists who haven't had specific training in dealing with affairs go about their normal business and inadvertently reinforce the idea that the affair was because of certain problems in the marriage. Well, all marriages have problems, so after the fact, you can always identify the problem and then assign a cause and effect.
Right.
It does is stop the process of looking at what else there is, because it's never one thing. Yes, there are always, whatever problems exist in the marriage are always going to be one part of the set of factors.
Okay, so that's what it is. I was taking it too literally. It's not that it can't be that, but it's not that in and of itself. That's what you're saying.
Only that. This is the problem with many therapists who aren't trained in dealing with affairs specifically. They allow it inadvertently to appear that that is it, and that if you focus on the problems in the marriage, you could have prevented it or you can heal from it by correcting those problems. That is far, again, too simplistic, too narrow,
right?
Much broader. So it's understanding it in the context, because what that really does is just reinforce the kind of sense of personal blame, personal shame, and devastation. Like, everybody else has a better marriage, and so it doesn't happen to them. It only happened because we had a bit. Everybody who is married has serious problems. There's just no two ways about that.
Well, I always like to say, if you're not dating yourself, you're going to have differences, and you have to learn to work them out.
Exactly. But, you know, you talked, one of the things you said that you have tended to believe is that, you know, it's because the connection is broken, the bond is broken. A lot of people have this idea, let's say we grew apart. Well, I have a real theory about growing apart. I don't think growing apart has to do with exploring different interests or doing different things or not doing the same things or not being, it has to do with not sharing what it is you're doing and what changes it's causing in you.
Right.
So you cease to know each other, not by virtue of not doing the same things, but by not staying in conversation about letting them know who you really are as you change. Because the problem is, we start out, if we've got, you know, you could check off the checklist of all the things to start marriage with. I had them all in spades, and a lot of people do. And yet we change over time, and as we change, we withhold. And this is why I say honesty. Honesty is the rock bottom to everything, and that always.
That's right.
It's too risky. What they don't appreciate is the risk in not being honest, because, for instance, when you first start getting attracted to someone else, you keep that secret because it's too scary to talk about it. Then when you move, so that allows you to focus only on the fantasy of the pleasure of the excitement of acting on it. Whereas if it's something you could talk about, it would undercut that. It would take it out of the realm of fantasy. It would diffuse it.
Absolutely.
People are so afraid of that they won't. In fact, when you first start going steady, getting serious, getting jealous, almost all of us as women will let our guys know we don't like it when they look at somebody else. We don't like it when they compliment somebody else. We don't like it in any way when they show they're attracted to me by us. And attractions are normal. So what we in essence do is say, lie to me, pretend you're never attracted to anybody.
Right, that's right.
And by doing that, it's the first step toward this kind of gap that has you keep, again, it's all about secrets. Because bottom line, no matter what it is that might tempt somebody to have an affair, I don't care what it is, there's one trump card. You're not going to act on it unless you're willing to be deceptive, unless you're willing to deceive your partner. So honesty is really the ball game. It doesn't matter how tempted you are or how attracted you are or anything. Most people can't handle a sexually open marriage. So unless you're willing to be dishonest and deceptive, that is the thing that will stop it. That is the thing that will prevent you from having an affair.
Okay, listen, Peggy, we're going to have to take a break here because we have a series of breaks, and, you know, that will lead into the next section. I want to talk about the experience. I want to talk about the suspicion, and you write some really good stuff about confrontation, when to confront and how to confront. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be back with Peggy Vaughn.
Now, back to Relationships 101 with Christine Niffen on KMOX.
Hey, this is Relationships 101. We're having a great interview with Peggy Vaughn. She is author of The Monogamy Myth, a personal handbook for recovering from affairs. Listen, Peggy, you said a minute ago, you talked about the honesty, and that's, you know, that's absolutely essential, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with the truth. The truth shall set you free, sort of, is my saying all the time.
Yeah, well, there's a qualifier of that, which I really, you know, maybe we can get into. I really mean responsible honesty. A lot of people hear the word honesty, and they relate it to letting it all hang out and telling it like it is. And, you know, if somebody says, can I be completely honest with you, the next words out of their mouth is some kind of criticism. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about responsible honesty, which is honesty that's undertaken between a couple specifically for the point of really knowing each other so that they'll have a stronger bond.
And you're talking to me, the thing I lecture about with people in relationship coaching and couples counseling, you're talking about vulnerability.
Exactly.
And to be, you know, sometimes people aren't as connected as they need to be. I always like to say, you know, listen, you're going to have to be vulnerable to reach the top of the mountain. The only time anybody really feels love is when they feel fully accepted for who they are as a person. And vulnerability is being yourself without the fear somebody's going to leave. So then let's say you don't do that as well as you'd like to in your relationship. And suddenly now, when you get to the part of confrontation, you really have to lay that vulnerability out of there because you're setting yourself up to be sucker punched when you have to go, are you having an affair?
Well, this is why most people don't confront it right away.
Right.
I mean, I'm probably on one end of the continuum. I waited 7 years, during which time I was almost sure it was happening, but I wanted to be strong enough to leave because back then, 40 years ago, you assumed you had to get a divorce if you found out. But there's still an awful lot of rationalization. You know, you'll have all the suspicions, but you don't want it to be true, and therefore you'll try to find a way to rationalize them away. Then there's a lot of denial. And actually, that serves a useful purpose because, you know, as far as confronting, it actually is useless to just say, are you having an affair? Because you will always get a denial. People having affairs have a general mindset, and this is what it is. It's never tell. If questioned, deny it. If caught, say as little as possible. So to just say, are you having an affair, is a useless endeavor. But what you really need to do is to first make sure you really want to know and are not just looking for reassurance. Because if you aren't fully open to hearing the truth, you certainly are not going to get it because the tendency is to not give it to you anyway. So denial is just kind of automatic. But the second thing that's important before you confront is being willing to either stay in the marriage or leave it. A lot of people will have a mindset that says, if I find out he's having an affair, I got to stay anyway for the kids or for money or because I love him or whatever. Or some other people will say, well, if I find out for sure, I've got to get a divorce, just on principle, you know, I've got to. If you have either one of those mindsets, you are not ready to confront it because the decision of whether or not to stay in the marriage has absolutely nothing to do with what happened before, how many affairs or what or anything. It has to do with what happens once they're exposed because, especially with men, they have blocked out any thought of possibly getting caught or confronting having any problem. And therefore, it's only at that point that they even come to their senses. And I don't want to make this sound negative. I work with both men and women, and men are devastated even in greater degree often than women are when they find out their wives had an affair. But it is true that men compartmentalize in a way women don't, so that being discovered for a man really means that he then has an opportunity for the first time to fully recognize what he's done and what it's done to his marriage. And so it's what he does then. It's is he willing to answer your questions? Is he willing to sever all contact with a third party? Is he willing to hang in through the, it takes up to 2 years to get past the emotional impact for anybody. I don't care if you're doing everything right. There's nothing that you can say or do that will quickly take care of this because it's really shattered everything that's gone before. So the whole thing about vulnerability, so you really are not ready to confront, and this is the biggest mistake that most people make. They so desperately want it to not be true that they confront in a way where they're really still hoping that it's not true, and of course that message is loud and clear, and they also have a certain mindset. So take however long it takes for you to know that you really want the truth and that you're open to staying or going. In fact, I wrote this initially. I mean, the book's in its third edition now. But I wrote it initially before that movie came out, Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Right.
For the scene
I remember
there,
that.
Almost exactly what I described. What I described early on was, if you want to have the best chance of getting an honest answer, you say something like, I think you're having an affair. I probably could find out if I got a private detective or I did something like that, but I want to know it from you. And if you answer me honestly, we'll work and see if we can make this through. If you lie to me now and then I find out later, I don't know that we can make it.
Well, let me tell you what, that's why this book is so helpful, because honestly, I mean, I think we change and grow as we evolve and become older anyway, because I remember my early years going, if anybody ever, you know, cheated on me or anybody who ever gets cheated on, nobody should ever stay. I mean, I used to think that in the young, naive days.
You still hear that from people of all ages. And here's my advice. If anybody, and they've been saying this about Phil Spitzer, of course, I mean, everybody's been coming out of the woodwork. Well, if me, I had this, that, and the other. Well, the case is she herself said back during Hillary Clinton standing by Bill that would never be me. I'd be gone. That's what Zelda Spitzer said at that time.
I know. Let me ask you this question.
And let me make this point, though. It's really critical.
Okay.
Anybody who says, if it happened to me, I'd, you can ignore the rest of the sentence because they don't have a clue what they would do unless and until it is them.
No, that's absolutely true. What do you think about, I had a couple calls last week, or one guy called up. A bunch of people wanted to talk about what they thought about her going and standing up next to him. What are your thoughts on that?
The thing is, it's different. Again, there's not a one-size-fits-all. In
right.
her particular case, like in Hillary's particular case, which is unlike Craig's wife and some others, you can't paint them all with the same brush. They have different reasons. Some are because they're just being the good wife, which is what I perceive may be the case with Craig's wife and with Vitter's wife and some of the others. They're just kind of in shock. Really rational, strong rational people like Zelda Spitzer and like Hillary Clinton, I think that they were stepping back and saying, okay, I want to address this. I want to be a problem solver. I want to see what I can do. And in both cases, Hillary wanted Bill to stay president and were impeached. Zelda actually fought her husband against resigning. He was ready to resign before she was. So you can't look at a woman standing there and assume that you know why she's there. Because many strong women who are married to powerful men and successful men and politicians, they feel almost like it's a partnership. They don't technically have the title, but they've been a huge part. And, you know, they're both lawyers and all this. So I think that you have to look at the individual and not assume that it's just a pitiful thing. Because one of the things is, it takes strength. It takes a certain level of confidence if you are deciding on your own to be there, which I think was the case with Zelda and with Hillary. With some of the others, with Vitter and
Larry Craig's port, yeah.
McGreevy, I guess it was McGreevy. With some of those, you know, you did not get the sense that they were there because they wanted to. You got the feeling that they were sleepwalking, that they were there because they've always been there, they've always shown up, they hadn't been able to assimilate it to even know what was going on or how to react. And I also think that you can't ignore the impact on that they're looking at. In other words, Zelda Spitzer, as much as it was fascinating, I mean, you couldn't take your eyes off her. You were listening to him but looking at her.
I'll be honest, I felt bad. She looked like she hadn't slept in days. I felt terrible for her.
I mean, she's certainly in a state of shock but trying to do the best she can. But
right.
I know from talking to so many people through the years, what she had more pain about right then was what this might be doing to her three teenage daughters.
Certainly.
She was trying to be, because what happens is your kids pick up on you. I remember how strong I tried to be because we told our kids, they were 11 and 13, and they take their cue from however you are. So a big part, and this is amateur psychology here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know her. I can't speak for her, but I do know from talking to enough other people that there is a very strong likelihood that she was trying to set an example of how she didn't wilt and wither and get in a fetal position so that her daughters would be more capable of staying the course.
You know what? That is a very, very excellent point and a very good point. Listen, we're going to take another break here. When we come back, we're going to talk with Peggy Vaughn, and we're going to talk about the healing process. How do you rebuild after this? How do you rebuild the trust? How do you rebuild the communication? And we'll be back.
Welcome back to Relationships 101 and Christine Niffin on KMOX.
Hey, thanks for staying tuned in to Relationships 101. We are speaking with Peggy Vaughn, author of The Monogamy Myth, a personal handbook for recovering from affairs. Listen, Peggy, I just want to say that this really is an excellent book, and I'm certainly not patronizing. I'm a Scorpio. We don't give false flattery.
That means a lot, yeah.
Thank you. No, I'm certainly not patronizing. It's an excellent book. It has opened my eyes to many things. It's, you know, clearly... It clearly illustrates all your surveys, all your work, all your research, all your talking with people, because you have so many perspectives and things that, you know, the rest of us just can't really think about and haven't thought about. And for myself, honestly, as a therapist, this is invaluable. And I realize I didn't know nearly what I might have thought I knew, and I don't have a problem admitting that. So
I'm very quick to say, though, that I really cannot take credit for this. I'm almost like a journalist in that I have collected so much information, and I know pretty confidently what usually happens and usually doesn't. What usually works and usually doesn't. And it's not because I'm smart. It's because I've learned, because so many people have shared with me.
Share with me a little bit about what you've learned about if somebody is going to rebuild, because if both people are going to participate, I tell you, when they come in my office, I've had this scenario before. Hey, that happened 10 years ago. Why aren't you over it? And, you know, I always like to say, maybe I'm wrong. Help me out. And please feel free to if I'm wrong. I always like to say the person who committed, though, might need to go a little above and beyond to rebuild the trust. I mean, you might need to check in a little bit. But you're saying that's bad advice, or you think that's okay advice?
Oh, I think you absolutely have to do a lot of things to rebuild the trust. See, trust is, we have this weird idea that you just can decide to trust, you know, that you can just bestow trust.
That's naive.
Trust is a byproduct of trustworthy actions over time.
Yes.
So the first thing is to not expect your spouse to trust you again for a very long time. That's the first thing. And you start helping them learn to trust you again by, first of all, I mentioned earlier, severing contact with a third party, answering all your questions, hanging in through the long period, and respect the fact that your spouse needs to talk to other people. See, here's the thing. You always want to keep it hidden. You want protection. You want cover. You don't want friends or family to know. But here's the problem in recovering, rebuilding. is if it feels too awful to talk about, it feels too awful to get over. So if you've got to keep it hidden, that makes it really hard, and that's really a sticking point for a lot of people. You need to be willing to report in about your whereabouts. You need to go to counseling with your spouse if they wish it. And like I say, the bottom line is you really need to understand that it's going to take at least 2 years. And that sounds so discouraging that most people who've had an affair are going to think, my gosh, am I going to have to put up with this for 2 years? The thing is, if you don't do the right things, it won't. 20 years, it'll still be the same thing. Time alone doesn't take care of it. And in fact, if you know it's going to take a long time, then you don't get so discouraged and depressed and hopeless and helpless and give up.
Right, but let me ask you this. You know, people have to work on pushing themselves to be vulnerable, to be open and all this. Now, I don't want to do what you said in the book. I don't want to overly assume that, you know, but let's say you have a marriage where there is an affair and it involves both or one person where they don't have that level of intimacy established already. And let's say they don't do a very good job. I mean, that's why I think people get together in relationships and they only come so close and then it just dissolves after a year or 3 years because they never formed any of that real intimacy. But let's say you, not assuming that that's only happening because of that, but let's assume you have a marriage where somebody's not very evolved in their ability to own their own parts, push to talk about things that are uncomfortable, all those things that I think go along with emotional involvement. So you've got two people that aren't very good at that, or at least one of them's not good at it. And then this happens. I mean, really, how often do people then go on after this when they didn't have those skills ahead of time? It makes me think of families that were almost a little bit dysfunctional, and then sometimes maybe somebody dies and it really just throws the family apart and they really can't get over that level of a crisis.
Oh, it can go either way. Like any crisis in life, it can destroy you or it can make you stronger and you can grow to be better. I always hesitate to say this, but I can guarantee you that it is possible when you didn't have the degree of intimacy, that the reason you didn't have it was because of all the secrecy that there existed. And if you devote yourself to establishing this kind of responsible honesty I'm talking about, you then get the kind of intimacy you never had before and maybe never would have had without this, not that anybody would ever choose to go through it, so that you can actually wind up with a better marriage than you had before. So it's like any crisis. Even if you didn't have intimacy before, that means it's not hopeless that you can't have it now, because now, for the first time...
Well, you might be forced to now finally have it, because that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger and bonds you together.
Yeah, Nietzsche's statement there is my favorite. But I can guarantee you that one of the things that people assume is that if they had intimacy problems, they had communication problems, that it's hopeless. This can be the kind of life-altering experience that can shake things up like any crisis does, and you find strengths and abilities and stick-to-itiveness that you didn't know you had. You see people lose legs and arms and stuff and then become a stronger person. The same thing.
Yes.
So you shouldn't assume that just because you didn't have intimacy that you have no hope of rebuilding. You do. But it's really important not to let people get too focused on the rebuilding and realize that that you can recover even if you're not able to rebuild. In other words, if you're who had an affair is not willing to step up and do the things we just talked about, that doesn't mean that you have to then never personally recover, because personal recovery is different from rebuilding the marriage.
Okay, Peggy, listen, I want to thank you very much. We're getting ready to head out here for a commercial. Listen, I want to thank you so much. This is a great book. What's the website if people need it?
Oh, Dear Peggy, DearPeggy.com. I have hundreds of pages of free information.
All right, you got it. Peggy, listen, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Well, I'd love to talk to you again.